due to Anadi Karana, the beginningless ocean of karmic reactions which we have managed to develop in so many lifetimes in this material world. Whatever traces of ignorance there may still be there, there may still be, due to their Anadi Karana, I personally remove. And then I manifest my transcendental qualities and my transcendental form for them. So, it's not a subject we can really go into right now, but Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in one other book, Madhurya Kadambini, he explains that a devotee, on the level of bhava, may still be affected by not so much their sinful reactions, but the after effects of their offenses. In fact, this is the main reason why a devotee who's on the level of bhava is not on the level of prema. You know, why should that devotee not be on the level of prema? There's no question of any sinful activity or anything. That's been left behind long ago. So why are they not on the level of prema, if they're on the level of dharma? Because there's still some traces, particularly of reactions to offenses. And he says, even when the devotee comes to the level of prema, there may still be some faint traces. But when Krishna reveals himself personally, then those last faint traces are completely removed when the devotee enters into their eternal relationship with Krishna. So that is what Krishna is explaining here. And that is like this, what we would say is this most confidential knowledge. And you can see that all this most confidential knowledge has been revealed by Krishna right in the middle of the middle section of Bhagavad Gita. In the later half of the ninth chapter and the first part of the tenth chapter, it's the very heart of Bhagavad Gita that this most confidential knowledge of the intimate relationship between Krishna and his devotees has been explained. So now Arjuna, having heard this, we're going on to the next section, 12 to 18. Arjuna is pretty astonished by all this, pretty overwhelmed. So he expresses himself that I accept you completely. Now I'm completely convinced. Not only am I convinced that all the great sages, Asita, Narada, Devala, Vyas, so many great authorities, they're convinced. You are the Supreme Lord. I accept you, and I accept everything that you're saying. Arjuna expressed that type of sentiment, or the beginnings of it, in chapter 2, verse 7. But now, Arjuna has reached that point that he's really convinced. Fully convinced. 14 and 15, Arjuna is making the point that only you know yourself. The demigods, demons, and others, they can't understand you. And then in verse 16, 17, and 18, he asks Krishna, "Will you please tell me about your opulences? I want to think of you. You told me, Maya Saktamana Parata. You told me that I should get my mind attached to you. So now I want to do that. So you please reveal things to me about yourself, which my mind will become attached to, and then I'll be very absorbed in thinking of you." In his commentary, in verse 18, Arjuna is saying that I'm never satiated in hearing about you. The more I hear, the more I want to taste the nectar of your words. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur makes the point that Arjuna's ears are becoming like tongues. We all know what the tongue is like. When the tongue decides it really wants to taste something very nice, that's a very strong impulse. So Arjuna's two ears are becoming like tongues. They're becoming overwhelmed with a blazing desire to hear about Krishna. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that Arjuna, or the pure devotee, experiences these subject matters about Krishna to be like a very special type of nectar drink. We all know what nectar drinks are like. They're very nectarian. But he says this is a very special nectar drink. Then he describes some of the qualities of it. He says it's like honey. It's a nectar drink, not like water. You just pour it and it just sort of splashes out. It's like honey. You turn it up and it oozes out. It's very thick and very luscious and very rich and very sweet and delectable. I don't know if you know what I mean. But it's a very special nectar drink that even when you're completely full, you just can't stop yourself taking some more. Like that. Just the most luscious experience for the tongue. So the pure devotee's ears are like that. They're tasting these glories of Krishna to be just like this rich nectar. So then from verse 19 to the end of the chapter, we're actually not going to go through all these statements, but Krishna is basically explaining about his manifestations mainly within the material world. He says, I am this, I am that. Of the Adityas, I am Vishnu. Of lights, I am the sun. Among stars, I am the moon. And so on and so forth. Now, I don't think there's really a need to go through all of these in detail. Maybe a couple we could refer to. But the basic principle is that it's not exactly that all of these things are Krishna in person. Like Krishna says in verse 22, among the senses, I am the mind. Now, in the beginning of chapter 6, we read a bit about the mind. The mind can be your friend, but your mind can be your enemy. I'm sure we've all had experience of our mind being our enemy. But Krishna's saying that I am your mind. So does that mean that whatever comes into your mind, that is worshipable? No. Our minds sometimes are like, sort of like rubbish bins. You know, at least that problem is there for the aspiring devotees. How to deal with the mind. But if you think, oh, my mind is Krishna in person, so my mind is completely transcendental and worshipable. That's not actually the case. But what is the case is that the mind is such an extraordinary thing. Where could such a thing as the mind have come from? Only from a very extraordinary person, and that is Krishna. So all of these things. Krishna's pointing out so many things within this material world which are very extraordinary. And they're so extraordinary that when you see them, then you can think that this is so extraordinary. It couldn't have come out of nowhere. It could only have come from some very extraordinary person, God, Krishna. So it's in this sense that Krishna is speaking. He says, amongst fishes, I'm the shark. Don't know if any of you have ever bumped into a shark while you've been swimming. I won't go into my past history, but I used to surf a lot, too much. And I almost bumped into two sharks on two occasions. I came within about 10 yards of them Fortunately, they were just cruising along. They weren't hungry. Otherwise, I might not be here today. But if I had thought, ah, a shark, there's Krishna. Krishna says amongst fishes, I'm the shark. Then thought, oh, I must go and embrace him. Well, anyway. But still, the shark, it's interesting, the shark, there are two living beings who have no enemies, no natural enemies. One is the human being. Human beings have no real natural enemies. They're capable basically of defending themselves against anything. And the other is the shark. The shark has no predators. So, very extraordinary. Where could such an extraordinary thing have come from? Only Krishna. Or Krishna says, I'm the gambling of cheats. So that doesn't mean that we should become expert cheaters and rascals and think that, oh, this is very good, I'm becoming just like Krishna. No, but the idea is these are all very extraordinary things. They could only come from an extraordinary source, and that is Krishna. So actually the whole of the rest of the chapter is taken up with this discussion. Krishna explaining that he's explaining in terms of groups, generally. Of hymns, I'm the Brihatsama. Of all poetry, I'm the Gayatri. Of fishes, I'm the shark. And of wielders of weapons, I'm Ram. So in terms of groups, one interesting thing, it's an interesting thing which is, I think, often misunderstood. In verse 34, Krishna says, among women, I'm fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience. So, of course, these are very good qualities for women. They're also very good qualities for men. If you have them, and we're hearing here that they are qualities of women. If you're a man and you have them, doesn't mean that you're somehow endowed with an effeminate nature or something like that. But actually what it is, there are two ways of understanding the statement, subtle ways, is that these words, in Sanskrit you have genders, three genders, masculine, feminine, and neuter. So these words are in the feminine gender. That's one thing. They're in the feminine gender, just like in French you have masculine and feminine, at least. Latin. So these words are in feminine gender. Another thing is that these are the names of some very famous women. Shri, goddess of fortune, Vak, the daughter of Lord Brahma. These are the names of some very famous women. So anyway, then Krishna concludes the chapter by saying that, this is now verses 39, 40, 41, and 42. He says that these things may be very impressive to you, but actually they're nothing. As manifestations of my potency, they are really very insignificant. In fact, whatever you find in the entire material creation is very insignificant. It's just springing from a spark of my splendor. So don't take it too seriously. So why? Why do you need to bother? You don't need to bother too much with all this. Who? Well, one. Try one.
Can you please repeat with reference to verse 3 of chapter 10, how this differentiates Krishna from the impersonal Brahma?
Because some people say that Krishna is the Brahman, but that Brahman has taken birth in the form of Krishna. But here Krishna says that he is Aja, he's unborn. So therefore this idea that Krishna is Brahman, but that Brahman has somehow taken birth as Krishna, that is not a correct idea. Because Krishna is Ajah. Just a
you explained that this verse 34, 10 chapter, it describes these feminine qualities, these names, these words also refer to different famous women. Can you say something more, because I never heard about...
Well, you've heard of Sri...
Yeah, I heard, but about
Vak.
No.
Vak is the daughter of Brahma. Actually, anyway, there's also Saraswati. Well, yeah, Brahma's got an unusual situation. His daughter is his wife. Anyway, he's very transcendental. But we know that there was a very extraordinary incident early on in the creation where Brahma chased after Vak. Anyway, I mean, I won't go into the intricacies of it, but Vak
is also name of Saraswati.
Yeah. Vak means words. And Saraswati also means words. She's the presiding deity of words or knowledge. Then the others made her. I don't really know so much about them, but they're famous ladies. Kirti, Sri Vak, Narinam Swati made her. They're famous ladies from Puranas. Sorry, I can't be more specific. Can
you? So I have second one.
Well, I don't think we've got time.
Did you say in regards to chapter 9, verse 32, that there are four categories of these characters?
Well, it can be taken as four categories, it can also be taken as three. Yeah. Prabhupada generally takes it as three. That this Papa Yoni refers to Stri, Sudra, and Vaishya. But the Acharyas also take the Papa Yoni to refer to those who are lower than Stri, Vaishya, and Sudra. The Chandalas, Lamechas, and Yavanas, and others, Karatas, Vinas.
What is the
significance
of Anya
Well, that's a good question. I don't know, actually. The holy fig. I don't know if any of you know. I couldn't venture a good answer to that. The banyan tree. Why is it so sacred, the holy fig? Well, it's one particular... There are different species of banyan. It's, as I understand, it's one particular species of banyan. Like the peepal tree, it's also related, that's also regarded as being very auspicious. But quite frankly, I don't know exactly why. Yeah, that's true. Just before Krishna left, he was sitting under a young banyan tree, leaning up against it, with one foot over his one other knee. Anyway, I don't know about that. Anyone else? Any other question?
Interesting. In 8th chapter, I ask about that because I don't have previous in verse 22nd, Krishna explained position of Supreme Lord, and he referred that he said that he because sometimes Krishna speak about Supreme
Me
Lord
and
that
he
and sometimes he
yeah right that's a good point that's
Lord.
A very good point
why Krishna in this
Me and he
said that he are Supreme Lord he is presiding.
Yeah. Okay, well, see, Krishna and Vishnu and Krishna and all his expansions are not different. Like Lord Nrisimhadev is Krishna, but he's not manifesting fully. It's Krishna manifesting in a certain feature of his nature, particularly his anger. But still it's Krishna. It's not like someone else, like you and me. I'm one person, you're another. Nrisimhadev is Krishna, but just manifesting in a special way. But at the same time, Nisshungadeva is Nisshungadeva. And you can't exactly say that he is Krishna, you know, Shamsunda playing the flute in Vrindavan. He's not. So therefore sometimes Krishna, when Krishna is referring more to the super soul or other expansions, particularly the super soul, then he sometimes, not always, but sometimes in Bhagavad Gita, he refers to the super soul as he and not me. Like chapter 18, verse, I think, 61. What is that verse? Ishvara Sarabhutana, Rideshara Junatishti, Ramayan Sarabhutani, Yachurudrani Maya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart. And then just after that he says, you should surrender to him absolutely, or something like that, completely. You should surrender to him. But now that's the super soul, Vishnu. Also he says, Sabhasya Cham Riddhi Sanavishto Mata Smriti Gyanam Aponam Cha, that I'm seated in everyone's heart. So it's a fact that the super soul is Krishna, but then again it's not exactly Krishna in person. So in order to distinguish himself, Krishna, the original form, from his expanded forms, sometimes Krishna refers to the expanded forms in the third person as he. As he. So here he's basically in chapter 8, he's referring to Vishnu. He's all-pervading, everything situated within them. That is basically Vishnu, the Lord within this material realm. Dr. James?
Which refers to verse 9-11.
Yeah, 9-11.
The form of Krishna is the absolute truth. And he used the picture of Krishna there on the wall as an example.
Yeah. Right.
So and he said that any bona fide picture of Krishna is the absolute truth. So I was wondering how we could understand that, first of all, what is bona fide, and that within any picture of Krishna is a complete absolute truth, including us.
Yeah. If that picture is done according to the instructions of scripture, basically, and it faithfully, sort of externally at least, it faithfully represents what Krishna essentially looks like, then that's accepted as bona fide. One way in which it's expressed, which is rather nice, particularly in regard to pure devotees who are artists, the pure devotee, who's an artist, is meditating on Krishna. And within his or her mind, the devotee is seeing Krishna very clearly. So now, because that's such an elevated devotee, then there's no doubt that that form within their mind is definitely Krishna. Krishna is present within their minds, within their hearts. So now, when they paint the picture, or carve the sculpture, or whatever it may be, then what do? They just take that form which is in their mind and just place it outside. So it's just that form which is Krishna within their minds, within their hearts, manifesting externally. So in this way it's definitely bona fide and can be accepted as being Krishna in person. Okay, so tomorrow we're going to read chapter 11. We may go on to chapter 12. So please do read chapters 11 and 12. Srila Prabhupada ki.